So let me start by making a little confession. I made a promise in 1999 that today I am going to violate for the first time ever. But it's a show of hands. How many of you know any of these names? Two people. How many of you know either of those names? Over half of you, all right? How about recognizing any of those people? How about that person? The promise I made in 1999 that I'm going to violate is I have never since 1999 spoken the name of any school shooter. Neither have I ever shown their pictures. Today I'm going to do both because I think it's necessary for this topic. The Adam Lanza here, whom you see, who shot all the children that you saw in Newtown, Connecticut. In the US, we have this interesting thing that occurs. Anytime there's a school shooting or another mass shooting, we ask the wrong question. We ask, what was the cause of this? And that is a wrong question because for human behavior, there's never a the cause. Humans are more complicated than that. That's why we've been talking today about risk factors. There are multiple risks for aggression. No one of them is the cause, ever. And so the minute we ask that question, we're already wrong. And no answer we can give can be correct. And then we often usually go another step farther, and we start saying, well, it was violent video games the cause of this. And it became very clear to me that, especially with this case, the Newtown massacre. So Adam Lanza shot 20 first grade children, 27-year-olds, and then a couple of teachers before taking his own life. And if we really wanted to be understanding how to, and then of course the questions became about his video game habits and things like that. But if we really want to understand how the media relate to school shootings such as this, we should be asking a very different question. Where did he get the idea that it would be a good idea to shoot a classroom full of first graders? That's a very strange idea. None of those first graders had bullied him, right? He didn't have a relationship with them. He wasn't taking revenge upon them. He didn't know them. Where did that idea come from? In fact, the word school shooter, that's not a real word. And yet, you all know it. How do you know it so well? Because the media use it so often. So where did he get this idea that he should shoot up a classroom of first graders? Well, that has to have come from the news media, right? Back when I was a child, when someone wanted to commit suicide, they just committed suicide. But nowadays, they have this idea that they should go take out other people first on their way out. And that idea probably comes from the way we've been portraying it in the media. Now, when we examine the forensic evidence left behind by many of these killers, it looks like they not only planned these things very carefully many times, but they also had somewhat grand ideas about what it was going to do for them. And so the Columbine killers shot hours of videotape of themselves talking about what they were planning. And they say that they're hoping to kill 250 people, the most deaths in US history. And we're hoping. They chose to do this on April 20th, Hitler's birthday, chosen very specifically. Many of the US shootings have been on April 20th, and other terrorist events, if I remember the Oklahoma City bombing also on Hitler's birthday as well. He'd be proud, I guess. Now, this motivation shown here isn't really new. I mean, how many of you have ever gone to visit the Temple of Artemis at Ephesus? Anyone here? Well, if you did, it looks like this today. Why? Because on July 20th, or 21st, 356, Herostratus burned it down, specifically so that his name would be remembered. And in fact, the Ephesian government had a law that said no one, on pain of death, You cannot utter his name for this crime he committed. And yet, 2,457 years later, we know his name still.
Columbine High School, April 20th, 1999. Its deadly legacy still echoes today.
Active shooter, Sparks Middle School, they have at least two down.
October 21st, 2013, a Nevada boy, only 12, shoots and kills a teacher, wounds two students, then takes his own life. Police find pictures of the Columbine killers on the boy's cell phone. May 1st, police say they stopped a Minnesota boy, 17, from bombing and gunning down his classmates. Here he is testing his homemade explosives. All these cases share one common trait. All the suspects were inspired by or somehow tied to the Columbine tragedy, when Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold hunted down and killed 12 students and a teacher in cold blood. ABC News identified 17 school attacks and 37 serious threats linked to Columbine since the massacre, among them the slaughters of Virginia Tech and Newtown. At least 10 of the cases came in the last year alone, as this disturbing phenomenon seems to be intensifying. In Pasadena, California, at the start of this school year, two students accused of planning another school massacre.
They just wanted to kill as many people as possible.
A three-month ABC News investigation spanning the country uncovered chilling evidence, video diaries, journals, police interrogations where the Columbine killers often emerged. Here's that Minnesota suspect talking to police in May.
My number one idol is Eric Harris. I think I just see myself in him.
This 16-year-old Tampa student was also allegedly planning a murderous nightmare.
I'm a Freedom High School shooter in Tampa, Florida. Well, I will be. Columbine, Virginia Tech, none of them will beat me. I'll kill them all. I can't wait to die, dude.
Perhaps no case demonstrates the Columbine obsession more than the 2006 shooting spree of this sadistic North Carolina killer. He convinced a family member to drive him to Columbine.
Columbine High School, right there. And you see over there? That's the library. That's where everything took place, right there.
He bought the same guns.
This, my friends, is what Eric Harris used in the Columbine massacre.
He even dressed like them.
Operation Columbine is underway.
Tragically, it was more than just play acting. The suspect shot and killed his father, then opened fire at his high school, wounding two students.
Remember Columbine!
He was arrested in this t-shirt.
They have taken an unusual fascination in Columbine and other large-scale horrific attacks.
The modern era of active shooter events really began with Columbine.
The copycat phenomenon is real.
They're looking to those attacks for inspiration, and sometimes it even turns into sort of a hero worship.
These troubled young men and women dream of unspeakable carnage. Those who've actually attacked, wounded and killed scores of innocents who should never be forgotten. In the cases we studied, 66 killed, 59 wounded. How can this dangerous phenomenon be stopped or at least slowed? We sought answers from Dylan Cossey, now 21, but who at 14 was arrested for allegedly discussing a plan to attack his high school outside of Philadelphia. Cossey told me there was no specific plot and that he does not believe he would have carried out an attack, but he admits to fantasizing about acts of violence against peers who had been taunting him.
What really drew me in to that dark path that I was on was that sense of hopelessness. And you start to associate with people who may discuss those kind of violent acts because they're the only people that at the time you feel that understand you.
He began researching Columbine.
And when I heard that these kids were bullied and that's why they did what they did, that's when the thought goes, I was bullied too.
Now, if the desire to become famous isn't really new, what is new? Well, the types of ways that we can get information around the world is really new. And the way you get your name in the newspapers and on television often is to do something exceptional, right? And so a RAND Corporation review of terrorist incidents found that 100% of terrorist incidents get named in the papers. So if I want to make sure I'm named in the papers, then there is a surefire way. Another study noted that terrorists, news people, and media experts share a view that those whose names make the headlines have power. And so representation in the media gives an idea, a cause, a sense of public identity, importance, and relevance. And no movement can get going without some visibility. But this is especially true when the movement's weak. So it gives the worse ideas a bigger boost than the good ones. But what else is really new? Well, although spree killers have generally read up about others and paid attention to previous murderers, and also pay attention to violent media, now they can also be influenced directly by the other killers themselves. Why? Well, because many of the shooters publish manifestos. This is the Virginia Tech shooter, published several things. And then he also took photos of himself, you know, in these hero poses, right? And then he sent videotape of himself to the news organizations. They use social media, including the Orlando shooting. During his slaughter, he stopped for 15 minutes to search himself and see how he was being talked about and how the shooting happening in that nightclub was being reported to make sure that he was getting famous enough. He stopped in the middle of shooting people to check himself out in social media. And then they create promotional videos, basically, and send them to the press or leave them where they can be found. Then archived photos and scenes can be accessed. You can actually go watch all of the footage from Columbine, from their lunchroom. It's out on YouTube. As you can see, it's been watched 2 million times. And here, where I stopped the tape at about minute 41, you can see they are all crouching down because the killers have come in and told them and started shooting and told them whatever they were saying at the time. So you can actually watch these people die over and over and over again because the footage is out there. And then they live on the internet forever. And then we turn around in the newspapers and news stations, and we give information about what weapons they carried, how many rounds of ammunition they had with them, what the caliber of all that was, what the body count was they left. We give a freaking high score for the next kid to come beat. And as you heard in that news report, many of the kids, that is their expressed motivation, is they want to beat the other ones. So a study found that at least 74 plots in the past 15 years were directly inspired by Columbine. That Columbine was named as a specific inspiration for what they were planning to do or what they actually did do. Why? Why is Columbine High School shooting such a big deal? Well, one reason, and this is what made me take my vow in 1999 to never utter their names, is that we made Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold heroes. We put them on the cover of Time magazine. Who else makes the cover of Time magazine? Oh yes, the president, the Dalai Lama. And they're up there in that company. Not only did we put them on the cover once, we did it twice, we did it three times. They've been on the cover of Time magazine. And then you see some of these, the footage of killers.
Look at me. Pretty cool, huh? This is a trench coat. Not, of course, the original one, but this is like a similar trench coat that Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold used in Columbine High School Massacre. This trench coat I got after I graduated from basic training. And here is our leader. It's just amazing what you can conceal with a trench coat. It's just awesome.
Operation Columbine is underway.
I don't know when it will occur, but it will occur next year. I mean, in a few months.
Now, we've known for many, many years that if we report suicides in the news, it can facilitate what are generally called copycat suicides. The classic studies in the 70s and 80s found that for about 2 weeks after a suicide has been reported in the news, suicides in that region will go up. Although some other studies have found that maybe it would last longer than that, a couple of months. And this is after a TV drama. So it's not even a real suicide, it's a fictional suicide. And although it's called a copycat, usually they're not really copying. They don't, commit suicide necessarily the same way. What we assume is happening is that it's disinhibiting, right? That most of us in this room feel pretty inhibited to kill yourself, right? Some people are perhaps fairly close to that edge, that threshold. And when they see it in the news media, that disinhibits. That shows it as normal. That shows it as acceptable. That shows it as something that people do. And this is related to what both Raoul and Barbara this morning talked about, normative beliefs about aggression. That as you see things in the media more, you start thinking they're more normal and more acceptable. So if we look at mass killings, and wonder, is there a similar type of copycat effect? A recent study looked at hundreds of different mass shootings in the US, whether it was a school shooting or other mass murder, and they statistically modeled the timing of these across many years. And there are a lot of mass killings in the US, unfortunately, mass meaning, I think, four or more people. And their model assumed that there would be a decay across time, that the influence of anyone should be decaying over time. And they found evidence that there is significant contagion, particularly for the mass killings. Now, they didn't only look at this. They looked at several other things like gun laws and such and found that many other things can influence it. But overall, they found that contagion following a mass shooting lasts for an average of about 13 days. So again, that two-week number. Now, remember, of course, their model assumed that the effect should taper off, and it to taper off fairly quickly. So they're not really able to look in this way for some effect that might last a year or more than that, like it looks like Columbine has. In a study of seven specific mass homicides in Australia, New Zealand, and the UK, they found that there were links showing that the killers were kind of modeling their actions after other ones. And they said that the media are a necessary link in that chain of causation, that without having the media to be able to tell them what the other people were doing, they might not have done what they did, at least not the way they did it. And they noted that the media effects for mass homicides may operate for periods as long as 10 years or more, in contrast to, say, just 2 weeks. So how do we reconcile those differences? Well, I think the two-week window partly is an artifact of our statistical modeling and the way we look at it. It's hard to notice an effect that happens over 5 years. It's much easier to notice when something similar happens within 1 week of something else. And it would be much harder for us to notice a longer thing. But it also may be that the two-week time window specifically matters for things that are for behaviors that need to be disinhibited, where that's the primary mechanism. But if we're talking about a mass shooting or a school shooting, often these are well planned out and thoughtful and carefully done over a long period of time. Yes, they need to also be disinhibited, but it's not like they're right at the edge and that's the last thing that's going to push them over. They have been working on this for quite a while. Now, even if it used to be true in the 1980s that after some type of mass shooting or suicide, the effect of copycats would last for 2 weeks after that, think of how the media are different now than they were in the 1980s. Now, it's not just you see it on the news and it goes away, right? Now it's archived, and you can go watch it over and over and over again. And then the media are now an echo chamber, that you see something on the TV news and it shows up in Twitter. Actually, often it's the other way around, that the news organizations are now watching Twitter to decide what they should report on. And then the social media come in and they talk about it, and then that talks, so they end up feeding a frenzy around a story between the social media and the blogosphere and the actual traditional media. Also, what's different is the killers now use the media themselves. And they are manipulating the media to make sure that they show their images, that they get to tell their story of why they did it and what they did and how awesome it was that they did it. And then the internet is completely different from anything that's gone before it, in that it, it narrowcasts at a one-to-one. You can search for exactly the thing you want to see, right? And then once you've found that thing you want to see, you can often connect to other people who are interested in the same thing. So the killers can talk to other killers. The people who are thinking about, of course, this is one way terrorist organizations, carry out terrorist, objectives across, when they're not physically next to each other. They're using the internet to be able to influence each other. Now, back in 1978, a sociologist looked at group behavior. And he said, when we think about groups, we tend to make an incorrect assumption. We think that everyone is making a decision on their own, right? If there's a riot happening, every individual in that group must be sitting there saying, should I riot or shouldn't I? What are the costs and benefits if I, what are the benefits if I do and what are the costs if I do, compared to what are the benefits and costs if I don't? And we assume that every individual is making their own decision, and we forget the fact that, in fact, the group is a very different being than an individual, and it makes decisions very differently. And this you can see, for example, if you're at a party, how many of you like being the first person to leave? No one. How many of you wait until, Craig? Well, that's because it's my party. That. How many of you wait till at least one other person has left? How many of you wait till more than one person has left, right? This is how you're being influenced by the group. And what he said is that when we're trying to understand this, and he used the example of riots, which I think is a nice one for us to think about here since we're talking about aggression. No one goes out in that crowd saying, I want to riot tonight, right? Or almost no one does. And you've got a bunch of people, and you could assume every individual has a threshold, what makes them willing to participate in the riot. And there are a couple rare cases in that group, especially if you have a big enough group, whose threshold is zero. They are willing to pick up that rock and throw it with no provocation, right? Once one person has done it, there are probably a couple people in the group who have a threshold of one. They've seen one other person do it, and now they're willing to. And now once those couple do it, now the number's up to three. And the people with a threshold of three, it's now crossed their threshold, and they join in. And once it gets to a big enough percentage of the group, it starts controlling almost everyone in the group. So if we relate this back to mass shootings, almost everyone has a threshold that's very high. What would it take? How many other people would have to do a mass shooting before you join in, right? Most of our thresholds are very, very high. Only a very small percentage of the population have a low threshold. But then the media don't just report the story once. They report it over and over and over. That every time you see it, click up your counter. And then the social media and the blogosphere and the internet, they all start chiming in and talking about it, and now we're repeating it over and over and over and over, and then the news media picks that back up again, and we've now raised the number up to hundreds, thousands off of one event. And the interested individuals who care about this, seek it out, they go look for it, which of course validates their attitudes. And then this information is archived and always there. It's not just like it builds and then goes away. It builds and stays there. And then the next thing happens, and that builds and stays there. And we're raising that number over and over and over again. And so then we start seeing, you know, the interested individuals showing some of the early behaviors. It's certain, sort of like you're in that riot. People are starting to throw things, and you're not sure you want to, but you pick up the rock. So you've got it in your hand. You know, and you're going to wait still. You don't really want to participate yet, but you also don't want to feel totally left out. So you've got your rock. And we can see this in a lot of the planning that the mass shooters go through, is they're kind of getting, they're building their rocks. They go get their arsenal. They make the little videos. Look, I have a trench coat. And so any single incident can now push the threshold not just to one, but into the hundreds, if not thousands, because we're reporting it over and over and over and over again. And that's very different from if we had to decide in this group whether we wanted to riot, right? The minute enough people leave, there's not a big enough threshold to push the other people. Or it's in contrast to things that happened in the past before there was an internet archiving them. So here in Australia, at King's Cross, you had a terrible problem a few years ago. I remember coming and I was asked to speak about it, about the one punch phenomenon, or King's punch phenomenon, where the idea is you go up behind someone who's not looking, and actually you saw it in that introductory video. There was a little clip of that. You go up behind someone who's not looking and you hit them, and their goal is to try to hit them so hard that you knock them out right away. And this was getting reported in the news, and the incidence was going up and up. Right? And then there started to be enough outrage about it, and started the way that it was being reported changed, so it stopped being quite as, you know, sensational, and then started looking at the, you know, various links and changed alcohol laws, and, you know, and now it's looked down on to do this, right? It's not seen nearly as cool anymore. So you changed the culture by changing the way you talked about it, and that has changed, that has brought that, you know, number, that threshold back down again. Now, as I noted, when we ask what's the cause of mass shootings, we're making a wrong, it's a wrong question that can only give us a wrong answer. And, Granovetter, the author of this threshold model, said it's a mistake to assume that if the members of a group make the same behavior decision, so they all decide to riot, that you can infer that most of them shared the same belief that it was okay to riot, whether or not they did at the beginning. That in fact what happens with the group changes, it changes your decision-making processes, and you don't actually share things with the other people around you. Some of them really like fighting and others don't, but yet you all ended up in the same riot. And so we do this all the time with mass shootings. We assume that anyone who did this must just be a bad person. We lump them all into one category of them, in contrast to us. You know, we're the good guys, of course. You know, the September 11th terrorists, of course, think they're the good guys. ISIS thinks they're the good guys. Everyone thinks they're the good guy. And so it's not true that they're all the same. But the minute we start thinking like that, we are going to miss the boat again. And the threshold model specifically predicts that the activity is going to catch lots of people who are different, who normally would not have done such a thing. But this also, this way of thinking about it also helps us to understand the lag, right? As these things happen and build up across time and they're archived and there's that threshold's growing, at least that archival threshold's growing and growing and growing, now you could see how Columbine from 17 years ago can still be influencing things today. Because you can still see it. You can still learn about it. You can still go look at their videos. Now, similar to what the threshold model says, there isn't one type of shooter. The FBI, the US Secret Service have all done things trying to profile school shooters or mass shooters, and they say there isn't one. They are not alike. They share some risk factors. They share some characteristics. The ones that are particularly interesting to notice from the FBI report here is they have an unusual interest in sensational violence. So they pay attention to the news media, right? And they're interested in going and finding that archival footage. They're fascinated with violence-filled entertainment. And they do a lot of internet searches to see about violence. They have role models like Eric Harris, like Hitler. They have role models that are negative. They have lots of access to media with themes, and their parents don't tend to monitor what they're doing. And that the FBI says there's a copycat effect as well. They say copycat behavior is very common. In fact, threats increase in schools nationwide after a shooting has occurred anywhere in the U.S. So when we look at how these shooters, what they pay attention to, the New York Times reported that most shooters do spend a lot of time researching the prior shooters. And they often critique them. I'm not going to play it for you today, but I actually have audio of a police interrogation where the police officer asks, what did Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold do wrong? And he has a very complicated critique about the way they built their bombs and the type of materials they used in them and why they didn't work and how they could have killed a whole lot more people, and his plan was going to be much better than theirs. So they're not only learning about them, they're not only looking up to them, they're critiquing them and trying to see how they can beat them. Now, the problem I have is that I think when we talk about copycat behaviors, we are making another mistake. Because we assume, when I tell you this is a copycat behavior, you assume that means there's no thought that goes into it, right? It's just copying. It's like what a three-year-old does. They just see it, they mimic. But that's not what's happening. None of these were true mimics. Instead, what they do is they learn the scripts. They learn what other people do. So why is it so many of these mass shootings end with a suicide? Well, that's the script, right? It changed, you know, they practice their new attitudes, and they seek out media that helps support those attitudes. They have detailed long-term planning. The media disinhibit these behaviors and desensitizes them to the real-world consequences. These copycat killers show hero worship of the prior killers, but then, like the U.S., we have baseball cards. You can read about people's statistics and how good they are. But rather than just knowing those statistics, which all of these killers do, they think they can beat them, right? Whereas I don't think I can go beat a professional baseball player's statistics. And so it's a competitive thing. And one way we can show that copycat's probably the wrong term, I'll tell you in a moment. What would be a better term? Well, I'm not exactly sure. Infection. Rowell likes this idea of contagion, so this kind of a viral metaphor, and I think there's a lot to that. Cultivation, we're cultivating these types of behaviors and attitudes, or we're grooming them. Contamination, and that, again, similar to the way a virus is spread, you can have it and not show any effects for a long time. You can show the effects in a different way than someone else does. That seems more like what's happening here than copycat. And so if we look at what happens after one of these events, specifically Columbine, in Pennsylvania, which is one of the few states that actually tracks how many bomb threats there were 309 bomb threats in schools in the month after Columbine, even though the bomb part of the Columbine plot was a really minimal one. Right? Mostly their deaths were by shooting, not through the bombs. They had created pipe bombs. They were bad at them. They didn't. Most of them didn't go off. And you compare this number to the full 3 years prior. There were 60 bomb threats across 3 years compared to 309 in 1 month. Now, is that a copycat? Well, yes, but it's not copying. They didn't actually do the same thing. And ABC News, our ABC, not yours, reports there have been at least 5,000 bomb threats since Columbine across the U.S., and there's an economic cost to each one of them being about $50,000 per threat, as they have to bring out the emergency teams and that's lost class time and things like that. Now, there are games that seem to promote this.
My name is not important. What is important is what I'm going to do. I just fucking hate this world and these human worms feasting on its carcass. My whole life is just cold, bitter hatred. And I always wanted to die violently. This is the time of vengeance, and no life is worth saving. And I will put in the grave as many as I can. It's time for me to kill. And it's time for me to die. My genocide crusade begins here.
It goes on. But if you notice, all the script elements of the mass shootings are right there, right? And reinforced in that game. Doesn't seem like a fun one to play, but I guess I'm not the right demographic. Now, you saw this young man, Dylan, who was arrested for planning a Columbine-style shooting at his high school. And he got lots of therapy during his years in jail. And notice, you heard some of this before, but I want you to pay attention to how he learned about Columbine and what effect that had on him.
Had you heard of the Columbine shooters, and how did that factor into your thinking?
I had heard of the Columbine incident probably 6 months or so before my situation began. And at first it started off as a simple interest because I had been kind of shielded from that incident when it occurred because of my age. And this was something I'd never heard about. I wanted to learn what it was. And when I heard that these kids were bullied and that's why they did what they did, that's when the thought goes, I was bullied too. There is people who understand me. And then when you start to delve into it more, you find groups of people who are still talking about how they were bullied too, they were hurt too, they know what it's like. And that's when you start to replace that sense of hopelessness with these circles of people who certainly should not be associated with.
So one of the risk factors for certainly school shootings has been have previously been bullied. And now we're back to why does media violence matter? Because all the research that you saw this morning is that media violence predicts greater aggression, not usually shootings, but that real-world aggression that happens on the playground, or what you might call bullying. And once that's started, now we're feeding this other cycle as well here. So this is why ratings are important. This is why following the ratings matters, and why we need to be informing the public about the risks of media violence. So what should we do? What are some specific things? Well, I think it's time to really change the way we think about journalistic ethics, or at least have some new conversations about it. And so I'm going to ask questions. I don't have all the answers for these, but I think these are some of the right questions. First of all, news organizations already have a policy they don't report suicides. Why? Because they know the evidence on copycat suicides. So unless it's a person of interest, an entertainer, a really famous person, they don't actually report any suicides because they don't want to copy, you know, they don't want the copycats. Well, all of these spree shooter incidents are suicides. They just happen to have mass shootings before it. Why are we reporting them the same way? In fact, now, you know, other researchers are also saying, you know, we've made school shootings a culturally enforced or sanctioned way of expressing suicidal intentions. We have changed this idea of what it means to kill yourself, is that now you should make the news doing it by killing a bunch of other people first. So I would say we should never name the perpetrators. or at least don't put them in the headlines. But I'd ask you, why do you need to know the name? Does it actually help you in your life to know the name Dylan Klebold? Why in the world do you need to know that? Yes, the public have a right to know about the news, but while do you need all those aspects? Do we need to know what they looked like? Why do we put their pictures up there, especially the ones that they sent as a press release, right, of them holding their guns? Why in the world would we do that and show their press kit to the world? We should not be talking about things like lone wolf, because that's a cool word, right? To a disaffected youth, saying they're a school shooter, that's a good thing to them, right? That's what they want. That's the crowd they want to be in. So we should be using different types of terms, active lone terrorism or perpetrator. And we also don't want to use terms that seem to vilify them, because that again is reinforcing to the kids who want to be in that club. So it's a tricky thing. How do we use language that says these shooters are jerks, rather not go so far that now they become cool, and not so I'm not quite sure what the right way is. But we also glorify in other ways. We talk about how this was inconceivable. Well, I promise you, someone conceived it, and the fact that you're calling it inconceivable validates them, that they got through to you, right? We stop needing to tell people what the score is to be. This is after the Orlando shooting, worst mass shooting in U.S. history. Okay, you guys just got to get 51. 51 and you win. Although many of these details, their name, what weapons they carried, how they committed the crime, what the timeline was, how they planned it, all those are very important for forensic reasons. Those are important for law enforcement. Those are important for perhaps public policy. But do you need to know any of that? Does it actually make your life better to know those details? Usually not. So again, I think we don't need to ever be reporting these types of details. We certainly need to gather that information, because that's important for the legal case. That's important for the police. That's important for perhaps things like legislation around gun laws or whatever it is. And then how it was done. I mean, there are video games where you can copy the Columbine High School. Go room by room exactly the same way they did, because we know all that information. But why do you need to know that? And so if we go back to suicides, the early research showed that the more details you give, the more people now copy those details. You've actually told them how to do it. You're educating the public in how to do these things. And then, of course, we do need to know how many people were killed. But there might be better ways to do it than reporting it as the high score. Now, I'm not the only one suggesting things like this. There's the No Notoriety campaign. There's the Don't Name Them campaign. A certain journalist like Anderson Cooper on CNN has often refused to name perpetrators on the air. The Brady campaign has the Zero Minutes of Fame campaign, where they have a Chrome plugin, which I have on my computer, where it takes out the names of all perpetrators and replaces all photos of the perpetrator with photos of the victim. Now, would this really help? Would doing some of these things actually make a difference? Well, first of all, it can't hurt, right? Nothing I'm suggesting really would harm you if we did this. And there is evidence that it can help. For example, in a study in Vienna, suicides on the subway were going up and up and up. And then they stopped reporting them. And as soon as they stopped reporting them, there was a 75% drop in suicides on the subway. And then that drop had lasted for 5 years when the study ended. So stopping reporting totally changed the suicides. And Barbara talked about reducing media violence exposure decreases aggression. And what was interesting is especially among the highest risk kids. So there is some evidence that, in fact, changing what we're seeing in the news might really change the culture. But it's not just whether it's there or isn't. How violence is portrayed matters. There are both high-risk and low-risk ways of showing violence, and those high-risk and low-risk ways have an impact. So one of the typical arguments, or used to be a typical argument by denialists, is they would say, the media in Japan are much more violent than the media in the US, and yet their murder rate is much lower. So therefore, media violence must have no effect. Well, there are lots of problems with that. First of all, you can't get a gun in Japan, and it's much harder to kill someone without a gun. And secondly, it's a culture based on saving face and not doing something that would bring shame to your family. That's going to bring crime down, too. But let's examine that first statement. The media are much more violent. What do we mean by that? And so in content analyses of Japanese media and American media, what we find is there's a lot more blood shown on the Japanese, because they spend a lot more camera time on the person, the victim. They show the victim suffering. They spend that time showing how horrible this act of violence was. And if we're just counting blood, yeah, it's more violent. But in fact, by showing it that way, the odds of you copying it go down, because that's cueing your empathy rather than making it look glamorous. It now looks horrible. And so the way we show it actually can totally change the effect, which is why I think the way we talk about these school shootings and these mass shootings could, again, totally change the effect. Now, there is a little bit of evidence that some of these, you know, voices for change are being heard. I was very proud of Time magazine. That is after the Virginia Tech massacre. The shooter's not there. It's just victims. This is after Orlando. If, similarly to the Japanese media, we spend our time talking about the victims, how much they were damaged, how much the victim's family are damaged, how much the community is damaged, what we can do to help, that might completely change this long-term copycat effect. Thank you very much.